Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. America's new leader. In a telegram, Pope Benedict gives Barack Obama his blessing and prays for the president to be granted unfailing wisdom and strength. Ecumenism opportunity. The Pope talks about the current week of prayer for Christian unity at his Wednesday general audience. Linking ecumenism and ecology, we find out how the London-based Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD, puts this principle into practice at the grassroots level. And Caritas Congo. A Caritas official from Congo tells us how the Catholic Church in his homeland is helping to alleviate poverty and suffering, whilst also seeking to increase dialogue with other Christian groups. And unwanted daughters. We find out how millions of baby girls are going missing in India due to the growing practice of aborting female fetuses because of the traditional preference for a boy.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Barack Obama, who was sworn in as America's 44th president on Tuesday, becoming the nation's first African-American leader. In his first major act as president, Obama has requested the suspension of all military trials at Guantanamo Bay detention camp, a promise he made frequently throughout his campaign. In his inaugural address on Tuesday, Obama emphasized the idea of respect for justice and the rights of the individual, rejecting as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. The new president also spoke of his desire to usher in a new era of peace, to responsibly leave Iraq to its people, and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. He also pledged bold and swift action to deal with the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Just hours before Obama was sworn in, Pope Benedict sent him a telegram giving his blessing and saying he prays for the new president to be granted unfailing wisdom and strength. The Pope said he prayed that under Obama's leadership, the American people may continue to find in their religious and political heritage the spiritual values and ethical principles needed to cooperate in the building of a truly just and free society. A society, he went on, marked by respect for the dignity, equality and rights of each of its members, especially the poor, the outcast and those who have no voice. Pope Benedict said that at a time when so many yearn for liberation from the scourge of poverty, hunger and violence, he prayed that Obama will be confirmed in his resolve to promote understanding, cooperation and peace among the nations. He concluded by imparting his blessing upon Obama, his family, and upon all the American people. The Church is currently marking the annual week of prayer for Christian unity. And this event was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis at his Wednesday general audience. Lydia O'Kane reports.
During his weekly general audience on Wednesday, Pope Benedict departed from his catechesis on figures from the early church, which for the last number of weeks has featured St. Paul. Instead, the Holy Father focused on the annual week of prayer for Christian unity, which began last Sunday, and explained more about this year's theme, that they may become one in your hand, taken from the book of Ezekiel.
The scripture passage recalls God's command to Ezekiel to take two sticks, one representing Judah and the other Israel, and join them together as a symbol of the Lord's power to gather his people into one. As Christians, we read these words as an exhortation to pray and work for the full unity of Christ's disciples. As the Second Vatican Council reminds us, there can be no ecumenism worthy of the name without a change of heart.
The Pope continued by saying that this week offers us all an opportunity to thank God for all he has done and continues to do to bring Christians closer to one another.
I'm personally grateful for the many opportunities I have had to meet with representatives of churches and ecclesial communities, both in the Vatican and during my travels abroad. Let us pray that the various initiatives this week at the local and universal levels will encourage all who confess one Lord, one faith and one baptism to listen more attentively to the Word of God, to deepen prayer and to intensify dialogue so as to imitate St. Paul's example of a life completely devoted to the Lord and the unity of his body, the Church.
During the course of Wednesday's audience, the Pope received honorary citizenship of Mariazell in Austria from the local authority there. It was given to him to mark the 850th anniversary of the shrine at Mariazell, which the Pope visited in 2007 to mark this occasion. Also on Wednesday, to mark the feast of St. Agnes, Pope Benedict blessed two lambs. As is tradition, the wool will be used to make the palliums, which will be bestowed on new metropolitan archbishops on June the 29th, the solemnity of the Apostles St. Peter and Paul. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Christians face to face with ecological crisis is the sub-theme for Wednesday, the fourth day of the current week of prayer for Christian unity. Susie Bruard is an expert on justice and spirituality issues at the London-based Catholic development agency CAFOD. She told me how CAFOD puts into practice at grassroots level ecumenical cooperation and initiatives to protect the environment.
Well, CAFOD is engaging with many different groups. It's very important to engage because the Church is one of a few voices calling out for the care of creation. So we are working with organisations such as Tear Fund and Christian Aid in the Stop Climate Chaos organisation. And we are involved in the Week of Prayer. We're having a joint service with Christian Aid this week. And we try and work at a diocesan level as much as possible with different ecumenical partners.
You talked about at the diocesan level. How much, in fact, does the Catholic Church at this level encourage cooperation with other Christian churches on ecological and indeed other issues?
Very much. Our diocesan managers, the CAFOD diocesan managers, which are based in each of the dioceses in England and Wales, that is the way they feed back and say to us that their volunteers and supporters only or just prefer to work ecumenically. So there'll be things like, for instance, CAFOD is launching its new climate change campaign in March, but there'll be a joint event in Coventry Cathedral on the 19th of March where partners from Cambodia who are involved in disaster risk reduction, they will speak. The head of Christian Aid and CAFOD will speak. There will be some bishops. There'll be a march around Coventry city centre, and we're hoping about 1,000 people will go. And so I think at grassroots level, it's much better, and it does happen, that people work ecumenically and even at interfaith level.
And when it comes to directly pressuring the government, maybe writing a joint appeal, is that also done very much in tandem with the other Christian development agencies, with the other Christian churches as an ecumenical initiative?
Well, it's still being worked out. But in fact, I think CAFOD and Christian Aid's aims and asks for this new climate change campaign are quite similar. We're both asking, for instance, for the recognition of and the support for the right to sustainable development of people in developing countries. And we're also asking, for example, for there to be a 30 to 40% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by industrialized countries by 2020. So it is very good that actually in the area of climate change, we do have similar aims and therefore are able to work together.
And do you find that amongst Catholics in general that there is a lot of support, a lot of sympathy, and a lot of approval of what you're doing in this area?
Very much so. We have a great supporter base. CAFOD has great supporter base in England and Wales and beyond. And I think this is largely because of our faith, from where we're coming from. The bishops of England and Wales produced an excellent resource in 2002 called The Call of Creation, which we at CAFOD are promoting and have made into a booklet and with cards and pictures that groups and churches can reflect on. Let me just give you a quote from The Call of Creation. It says, "What is happening to the earth indicates that we must think beyond local and national interests and define the community in global terms. The way we live and the choices we make affect the lives of others. Not only human life, in fact, but also the other forms of life found on the earth." And we have it from Benedict as well. Benedict the 16th in 2007 said, "I invite all of you to join me in praying and working for greater respect for the wonder of God's creation." So I think Catholics and other Christians just need to look at their whole history from Genesis onwards, which advocates that we should care for creation.
And zooming in to look at the Catholic Church in England and Wales in particular, it does have a number of ecological initiatives and groups that are very active, aren't they, to campaign for greater awareness of the threats to our environment and to protect, indeed, our environment.
There are a lot of organisations in England and Wales, for instance, Operation NOAA, which is an ecumenical initiative, and also, for instance, coming from the Third European Ecumenical Assembly in Romania in 2007, an initiative called Time for Creation, which encourages churches between the 1st of September and the 4th of October to really have environment at the heart of their worship. And there's also, of course, Christian Ecology Link that CAFOD is part of.
So anyhow, at CAFOD, there's very much a feeling, is there, that ecumenism and working to protect the environment do go hand in hand.
Indeed, CAFOD is part of the Live Simply network, which consists of 60 organisations, including four ecumenical partners. And the aim of the Live Simply network is to promote living simply, sustainably, and in solidarity with those who are poor. And that sustainability, of course, has got to do with climate change and also reflecting on our lives and our lifestyles.
What further cooperation would you like to see in the future? Have you got any plans to step up this cooperation?
I think that's for the future. We'll see what happens. What we're all working for now is towards Copenhagen, the UN summit on climate change, which takes place in December. And that's what I think most organisations are working to and really lobbying government and politicians around.
I was speaking to Susie Bruard, Justice Spirituality Facilitator at the Catholic Development Agency CAFOD in London. The huge African nation of Congo has been racked by civil war and conflict for more than a decade. And in recent weeks, LRA rebels from the neighbouring country of Uganda have been committing atrocities in the east of the country, where they are reported to have killed more than 600 Congolese civilians. Many of them died in a brutal attack on a church on Christmas Day. Father Pierre Chimbambo from the DR Congo is the Caritas Liaison Officer for Africa. He talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about how the church in his homeland is helping to alleviate poverty and suffering, and is also seeking to increase tolerance and dialogue with other Christian denominations.
This is affecting all the Congolese population in this particular part of Congo, and because here this is happening in the Dungu-Doruma diocese, where the militias from the Lord Resistance Army, these are Ugandans, they have been attacking civilians and killing civilians in this part of the Congo. And recently they attacked a church where the Christians were gathering for prayer. So they burned the church and they killed all the civilians who were meeting in that church. But this is not new. This has been ongoing for a long time, let's say, since these militias from Uganda crossed the border and entered into Congo. They have been really committing atrocities against civilians, and this is horrible.
Perhaps you could talk to me about the humanitarian situation for everyone in Congo and areas of Congo at present.
As you know, the war in Congo has been ongoing for the last 10 years at least. And of course, in a situation of war, you cannot expect that the human rights to be respected. And the human rights have been violated in most of the country, especially in eastern Congo, where the militias are many and where they have been fighting the Congolese government. We constantly hear about rape, about killings, about sexual violence. And so this has been ongoing at least for the last 10 years. This situation has not changed, and this is a very alarming situation.
I want to turn to the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. And when we think of Christian unity, we think of healing divisions and promoting dialogue. How can this be applied to the Democratic Republic of Congo following its years of conflict?
You are right in saying that Christian unity is about healing divisions and promoting dialogue. But this is true for a country which has been devastated by conflicts and war like the DRC. But I think this is also true for every country and every community, where those who believe in Jesus and in his message have to be witnesses of peace and promoters of justice. So it is important that every country and every community deal with its conflicts through dialogue and respect. And this is critical for conflict transformation and conflict resolution, as I think confrontation and war do not lead anywhere in terms of development and prosperity. Confrontation, as we have seen, especially in Congo, confrontation and war lead only to destruction of lives and to despair. This is what we see in this country, where more than 5 million lives have been lost. So Christian unity is about healing division and promoting dialogue, and this is extremely important for all the Christians and for the entire church.
How can churches play their part, do you think, in bringing about reconciliation, promoting peace and bringing about peace? How can they play their part in this?
Let's talk about Congo. This is a country where probably 80% of the population are Christians and 50% of the 60 million are Catholics. For more than a century, the Catholic Church has, I think, contributed to the evangelization of the Congolese people. And I think in its evangelization activities, the Catholic Church in DRC avoids proselytism. And this is important in a country where religious activities are mushrooming due to poverty and misery. I can also say that the Church is promoting the unity of the Christians and that of the Congolese people through its engagement in various social, humanitarian and development activities. As you know, the church in DRC is, for example, hugely active in the education and in the health sectors. To just give an example, I'm from the Archdiocese of Bukavu, and this diocese itself is running more than 400 schools, as well as a Catholic university. This is a diocese which is also responsible for more than 10 hospitals and about 100 health centers. So all over the country, let's say Caritas structures, development offices, justice and peace commissions are working hard to bring humanitarian assistance where this is needed, and also to contribute to the fight against poverty through, for example, agriculture activities, support to income generating activities at community level, We all know that poverty is a factor of conflict and division. So fighting against poverty is also a way of promoting peace and building trust and understanding among communities.
Father Pierre Chimbambo from Congo, talking to Lydia Kane. In India, becoming pregnant with a baby girl can have fatal consequences. Such is the traditional preference for a boy that millions of female fetuses are being aborted, and the number is rising each year. Some commentators have called it a silent but massive suppression of human life on a scale that is almost akin to genocide. Girls in India are often viewed as a burden, not least because tradition demands that a girl's family provide a dowry for their daughter's marriage, a practice that continues today even though dowries have been ruled illegal. Another factor that helps explain why so many unborn baby girls are not living to see the light of day is the growing use of sex determination scans for pregnant women. Here again, the practice is illegal, but the law is widely flouted. Often when the parents discover through the scan that their unborn child is a girl rather than the longed-for boy, the decision is taken to abort the fetus. As a result of this growing trend to abort the female child, the ratio of girls to boys is dropping rapidly throughout India. In 1991, there were 945 females to 1,000 males. But 10 years later, that had dropped to just 927 females. And in some states, such as Punjab, the number of females being born compared to males is dramatically lower. The Catholic Church in India has spoken out strongly against the practice of female feticide and has earmarked the 8th of September as Girl Child Day to help persuade parents of the equal worth and dignity of both boys and girls. The church says girls are not just being selectively killed in the womb in India, but in some extreme cases are left to die after birth. In addition, girls are often neglected or mistreated throughout their childhood and then by their husband's family when they marry. Cardinal Oswald Gracious is the Archbishop of Bombay and the president of the Indian Catholic Bishops' Conference. He calls the selective abortion of baby girls in the womb a diabolical practice.
I think it's because of the whole idea that the girl is a second-class citizen. We are trying to fight against that forcefully. You see, traditionally, a girl in many places was considered a burden, partly sociologically because economically she had later on take dowry, etc. Therefore, families did not consider it a blessing when a daughter was born, but it was a blessing when a son was born. Now, with the possibility of determining the sex of the fetus, people have gotten to the idea of female feticide. And this, as you can see, is diabolical because it's not only taking life, but also taking life selectively of women.
But how many baby girls are being aborted each year in India? And where is the practice most common? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Sister Lily Francis, who heads the Catholic Bishops' Commission for Women and Children.
Around 500,000 female fetuses are aborted every year.
And where is the practice most prevalent?
It is practiced in Punjab. For every 1,000 boy children, they have only 300 girl children in some part of Punjab. But even Delhi, it is affected. Delhi ratio, as per the census, 808 girls for 1,000 boys. Also, we see the third child in the family, usually the ratio goes much, much low, 312 girls for 1,000 boys.
So in many areas of India, there's now a very distorted ratio and a glut of boys in a way.
Yes, yes.
Maria George Loy is a Catholic sociology student in New Delhi who has done research into the practice of female feticide. She spoke to me about the widespread bias and discrimination against females in Indian society that help explain this growing trend to abort baby girls.
I think the reason why it is increasing is that women are constantly being considered as a liability in India because of factors such as dowry. And women are considered as a liability because of the dowry amount that has to be paid when they get married. And because they are getting married to a family that is outside, the woman does not prove as an asset to her own family in which she was born.
Experts say that although Indians know that female feticide is being widely practiced, thanks to the growing availability of sex selection scans, people don't like talking about it openly. And in many of these cases, the pregnant woman is being forced against her will to abort her unborn baby girl because of pressure from her husband and his family. There are some cases where the pregnant woman will rebel against this pressure to abort her baby girl. But as Loy explains, when women do this, they run a serious risk of being badly beaten by either her husband or his family.
Women, when they rebel, they are battered, they are pushed and they are kicked so that the child somehow is aborted.
So you're saying that if the woman does not agree, violence is likely to be used against her?
Yeah, if she opposes that, yes, I will have my child against the wishes of the family, she is battered. Many succumb to the pressure, and even if the child is allowed to live, she is not looked after properly by the in-laws, or the woman is not encouraged enough to educate the child, or she is not given the means to educate the child or to look after her properly.
Despite the worrying statistics, Cardinal Gracious says he hopes the trend towards aborting more and more female fetuses will diminish eventually, as people come to realise the implications of this practice.
I think that as people get more educated, as people get more enlightened, as people the world is becoming more and more a little village, people see the role of women in society, I am hopeful that this trend will gradually begin to diminish, and I hope it will die out completely.
There's a saying in Indian society that raising a girl is like watering a plant in your neighbour's garden. With attitudes like this, there's little wonder that so many females in India are being denied the right to be born. But, as Loy reminds us, it's difficult to change deeply rooted attitudes and traditions in a hurry. Happily, as Loy herself made clear, she does not share the bias against female children felt by so many of her compatriots. Let's end with her views.
This attitude does prevail, and I think it has nothing to do with education as such. It is a mindset that has been inculcated in the people, something which is widely said around, that the girl child is a liability to the family.
Are you married?
No, I'm not married.
But when you say were to get married, I assume that you would be fighting very strongly for the right for any girl child that you were carrying to be allowed the right to be born.
Yes, definitely. I would love to have a lot of girl children, and I will definitely fight for her rights.
I was speaking there to Maria Loy from Delhi, and you earlier heard the voices of Cardinal Gracious, Archbishop of Bombay, and Sister Lily Francis. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.com. Laudato Jesus Christus.